Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
Shmooze is sponsored for Yifur Shalema for Shabsai Shmuel Eliyahu ben Tzara Esther and Yechiel Avram Avigdor ben Rivka Iter by Hudi Newman. As we discussed last week, the Abarbanel asked the question that Yonah should not be part of the Kisvei HaKodesh. The story of Yonah, the entire Navi, is dedicated to the story of Nineveh, which is a Gentile city, and it seems to be an entire story of the events that occur to Goyim, to Gentiles, which doesn't belong in Kisvei HaKodesh. And the Abarbanel explains that actually there are a number of reasons why Yonah was included. And one of the reasons, interestingly enough, is to tell us the tokev chasiduso, the extreme piety, the extraordinary righteousness of Yonah. And as we pointed out last week, the extreme piety of Yonah doesn't seem to be immediately transparent. However, the Abarbanel explains actually that it is. And he explains the background of what's going on and why it demonstrates Yonah's extreme piety. The Abarbanel, as I mentioned, explains that really Hashem had a plan. And Hashem revealed that plan to Yonah. The plan was that Ashur, the Assyrians, were to exile the Jewish nation. The Jewish nation were no longer who they should have been. The Jewish nations were now Ovdei Avodah Zarah. And Hashem was going to send Ashur to exile the Jewish nation. If it could be, Hashem had a problem. And that was that Ashur were no longer fit to remain alive. They were so ra, they themselves were so wicked, that they also deserved to be destroyed. Hashem was sending a Novi to Ashur to get them to do tshuva so that they could exist, so that they could exile the Jewish nation. The capital city of Ashur was Nineveh. Hashem was sending Yonah for the sole purpose of getting Nineveh and Ashur to do tshuva so that they could be alive, so that they could exile the Jewish nation. At which point, Yonah said, no, count me out, I'm not a part of it. And in fact, as we mentioned again, the Abarbanel was very clear that Yonah's sole intention was to run away from the Nevuah. He understood that the Nevuah was to be in Eretz Yisrael, not outside of Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, he ran away. He got onto a boat, and it didn't matter where, as long as it was off the mainland of Israel. And the Mechilta explains that he was clearly prepared to die. He paid the full fare so that there should be no one else on the boat. When the sea began raging, he went to the bottom of the boat because he thought that Hashem would drown him first. When they drew the various lots, many, many lots, they all came out on Yonah. He said to them, throw me in, it's your only choice. It's the only way you're going to exist. The Tana Be'eliezer says even more clearly that he told them, try me, test me if I'm not right. They put a rope around him and put him in. When they put his body into the sea, the raging sea stopped. When they pulled it back up, it raged again. In the end, they saw, the sailors on the boat saw, there was no hope other than throwing him overboard. In fact, they throw him overboard and he's swallowed up by the fish, by the dog. Now, in that dog, the story changes. In that dog, Yonah does tshuva. In that dog, Yonah turns around his whole path. And you'd imagine that something very, very powerful and very, very moving happened to Yonah in that dog, because up until that point, he wasn't budging. He clearly understood that he was going to die. Remember, he did not know that there's going to be some huge fish to swallow him up. He stood against Hashem and he said, I'm not part of this game. If you wish to destroy the Jewish nation, you do it. It's my people. I love them. I'm here to serve them. I'm not part of their destruction. And nothing could get him to veer off that choice. Hashem himself demonstrating miracle after miracle could not get him to change. The fact that he was going to die could not get him to change. And the fact that likely he was going to lose his Olam Haba would not move him. But something in that fish, something about those 3 days in the dog, changed him. And it's very interesting to note that Rashi explains to us what about the dog changed him. So in Perek Beis, the Pasuk says, V'yamayin Hashem dag gadol. Hashem made appear a very large fish. Livlo as Yonah, to swallow up Yonah. V'yonah b'mei adag shlosh yomim shlosh leilos. Yonah was in that fish 3 days and 3 nights. Then the Pasuk Bey says, Vayispalel Yonah el Hashem Elokav, and Yonah davened to Hashem his God, Mimei HaDagah, from the innards of the Dagah. In Pasuk Aleph, it was called a dag, a male fish. In Pasuk Bey's, it's called a Dagah, a female fish. And Rashi picks up on this inconsistency and says, actually, that was part of the plan. Says Rashi, Dagodl Zohar Haya. Initially, when Yonah was thrown overboard, a male large fish swallowed him. Vayomid berevach, he was standing comfortably. There was plenty of room inside the male fish. Lonason levelis palel. Therefore, he didn't pay attention to Davin. He didn't do tshuva. Remez HaKadosh Baruch Hu ledag. Hashem called the dog vikiu, and this fish, the male fish, spit him out. The tochpia shel nekeva, into the mouth of a waiting female fish. Shaisa malea ubrim. The female fish was filled with many young. It was pregnant. Vaisa sham bedochek. In that fish, Yonah was very squished. He was bedochek. He was uncomfortable. Vaispalo sham mimei hadagah. And that's why he davened from the mei hadagah. It's because it was a female fish. He was uncomfortable. He was squished. That's why he davened. That's why he did tshuva. So it seems that Rashi is explaining to us that he held fast. Nothing would budge him. But it got a little uncomfortable. Oh, forget it. Throws in the towel. And the question is rather obvious. The question is that this is a man who can stand up to anything. This is a man who stands on the deck of a boat that's threatened to be destroyed at sea and says, I will not budge. Nothing moves the man. Nothing. But all of a sudden, it's a little uncomfortable. All right, Hashem, I got thrown in a towel. I didn't know you were serious. I didn't know you really meant business. I mean, Mamish, uncomfortable? I mean, I'm going to have to be squished a little bit? And it sounds to be a Pella. It sounds if you have such a man of such idealism, such a dedicated man, that nothing can get him to budge, and, but the minute it's uncomfortable, oh, then he throws in the towel. So the question that I'd like to address this evening is, what's pshat? Why is it that such an idealistic man, a man of such drive, can be changed with something so seemingly insignificant? The minute it's uncomfortable, that was the changing point, and apparently that changed Yonah. And it's that question I'd like to see if we can address this evening and get a better understanding as to this entire concept of comfort and suffering. And let me begin with a rather famous Gemara. The Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Gimel Lamed Beis, brings down the Maisa of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai. And the Gemara says that the Romans wanted to kill Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. There was a decree against him, and he had no choice but to hide out. Initially, he and his son ran to a very secret Beis Medrash, and each day his daughter would bring them food. At one point, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says to his son, "Women are daitan kalos. What if our daughter? What if she gets captured? What if my daughter gets captured? They'll torture her. They'll find out where we are." At which point, they ran to a cave. They ran to a cave, and the Gemara tells us there was a nes. No one knew where they were, not even his own family. There was nothing for them to live on. A nes happened. Isra'am Elohu Harva, a carob tree appeared, and there was a small well, small stream of water, and they lived there. They were able to survive in that cave on the caribs and the water, and for 12 years, they lived in that cave. According to some, that's when Rav Shimon Bar Yochai wrote the Zohar. But for 12 years, they were osek yoman v'layla in nothing. Nothing but Torah and Tefillah. And that's how they remained. At the end of the long 12 years, Os Eliyahu came, v'kama pisa de marasa. Eliyahu comes to the opening of the cave. Amar man ludi l'bar Yochai. Who will tell Bar Yochai the Mace Kaiser? Apparently, Eliyahu would not speak directly. He's just said it in a remez. Who will tell? Who will inform Bar Yochai that the Caesar died, or batel gzeirasa, and the decree has ended? At which point, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and his son understood that they were safe. Nafku, they went out. And then the Gemara tells us that the first thing they did when they got out of the cave was chazu inchi. They saw men, the kakarvi vizari, who were plowing and harvesting. They were engaged in produce. Here are these men, Jewish farmers, leaving Chai Olam, leaving Torah study, being involved in mundane issues, livelihood. Kol mokum shenosin einayim, wherever they placed their eyes, miyad nisrof, immediately was burnt up. Wherever Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai would look, if it was not totally kadosh, not totally pure, immediately was burnt up. Yotza Baskol v'amra, Baskol comes out and says, l'hachriv olomi yotzasem, you came out of the cave to destroy my world. Chizru l'maraschem, go back to your cave. And in fact, they had to go back to the cave for an entire year, and they came back with a different attitude. And I'd like to ask one point on this Gemara. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, before he went into this cave, was a great, great Torah scholar. He and his son both. Yet when they came out of the cave, the minute they see someone being involved in working in something mundane, they were so enraged, so aghast by it, that literally they burnt the man alive. What changed in the cave? Before Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai went into the cave, he had a full understanding of why Hashem created the world. He had a full understanding of the value of Torah. And I'm sure he understood that there were important things and less important things. He didn't get any new chidushim that Torah is important or not important. He didn't now discover that Hashem created the world for Olam Haba and not just for man to make a living. So what changed? And the answer, my friends, is nothing changed in terms of his yediyos, in terms of his knowledge, but what did change was an attitude. There was something that he understood from the time he was a very young person, but it became much more clear, blazingly clear. He understood the value of a moment, he understood what a human being can accomplish, and he saw people doing just regular acts. And he said, people, human beings created in the image of Hashem, and you're doing just regular things. You're created for greatness. You're created for godless. You're created to be a ben olam haba, to do things that will last on for eternity and forever. And you're being involved in mundane, passing, fleeting things. But it wasn't the knowledge that changed. It was his attitude. He knew it all along, but that the 12 years in the cave brought it much more to bear, much more clear. And when he walked out, he had a totally different attitude towards life. Albeit at that point too sharp, but that attitude sharpened by 12 years of learning. On May 8th, 2001, Kobe Mandel and his friend Yosef Isran cut school. They went hiking. They went hiking near their home in Tekoa. The next day, the two young boys were found dead, stoned to death by Palestinians. And not just stoned to death, brutally stoned to death. They described this, not little stones, you think of little stones, the size of bowling balls. A number of Palestinians caught them and they were left there. His mother, Sherry Mandel, was a writer, an American-born writer, and she wrote a book. The book is called The Blessing of a Broken Heart. And in it, she describes a scene. About 4 months after the death of her son, she was in a JCC, and she overheard in the locker room a conversation of some women, and the conversation was about, my daughter just bought something in JCPenney, it's the right size, it's not the right size, Land's End has a sale, you can get boots, but I don't know if you need those type of line boots over here in Israel because it's never as cold as it is in America. Did I have half size? Back and forth the discussion went. And she said she was aghast. She couldn't believe the conversation. How could you be talking about such fleeting, mundane, silly things? And she described that she felt like Rav Shimon bar Yochai coming out of the cave. Because here she had just lost her son and understood the value, the preciousness of life. And how could you talk about such mundane, silly, trivial matters? Near-death experiences have a very real changing effect on a person. The Bali Musar say that they're makane. They were jealous of a human being who had a near-death experience. Because apparently such an experience changes a person. It changes their attitude. It changes their life. They're never the same. Because when you see death right there and you escape it, you understand the preciousness of life. You understand what you can accomplish, and you have a wholly different approach and a different attitude. And somewhat like Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, you can't look at life in the same way. You can't look at the way people squander their time in the same way, because you're a changed person. And like a Sherry Mandel, when you see your own son go to his death, you can't be as fleeting, you can't be as shallow. There's got to be more to life, there's got to be more meaning. And I believe that that near-death experiences, feeling death, being close to it, is not the only thing that shake a person up like that. Pain, suffering, can have a similar effect. If you talk to a person, Rahman al-Atlan, who has been diagnosed with cancer and had to live through Gehenim in this world, and they come out of it, it's a very different person, with a very different sense of values, with a very different sense of the importance of life. Just that experience, the pain and suffering, even if it doesn't necessarily involve death or the threat of death, just being there humbles a person dramatically, makes a person much more down to earth, brings a person to certain core realities that they understand to be true but never quite feel. And my friends, I believe that that's exactly what happened to Yonah. You see, at the end of the day, Yonah was wrong. Yonah stood up to Hashem with a cheshbon. The cheshbon is, it's my people, it's my nation, I love them, I'm here to serve them, and I can't do for them anything that would be but good for them. I can't be a part of their exile, I can't be part of their damage. And he said to Hashem, you're the master of the earth, you have a plan, but count me out. But gentlemen, he was wrong. He was wrong, and deep, deep down within the soul of Yonah was a knowledge. He was a Navi. And within him was this gnawing sort of thought that I'm not right. It's a very beautiful concept. It's very ideal. It's wonderful, but it's also wrong, because Hashem is the Shofet Mishpat, and Hashem told me to do otherwise. But when that voice would surface and it would say, come on, it's not the right thing, he'd push it away. He'd push it away, albeit with a very holy Nagiyah. Not a Nagiyah for Taiva or Kavod, a Nagiyah to save his nation, but at the end of the day, it was right and he was wrong. And what brought him in sync with that idea was suffering, pain, not even extreme suffering. Rashi doesn't say that it was so horrendous. Rashi doesn't say he couldn't barely breathe. It was uncomfortable. For 3 days he stayed in a cramped, uncomfortable quarters, and what that did on some level, humbled him, changed his thought process, allowed him to come to that reality that he knew to be true, and that is that he was wrong. And I think it's an amazing illustration of a man as idealistic, a man as dedicated to a cause as Yonah, but wrong, pain, suffering, hardship can bring him to an idea that's emes, that he knows to be true, that he's been denying all along, but it's that painful experience, that suffering, that can bring him to that knowledge that he always knew to be true and can make him make the right decision. And I believe that that's exactly why Yonah was changed. Not the threat of death, not Hashem himself revealing himself, it didn't matter. But pain humbled him, pain changed him, and suffering is what allowed him to reach that idea that he knew to be true all along. And I think it's a very important lesson to us, because we suffer. And suffering is part of life. However, I believe that in many senses, we don't really suffer much at all. The average lifespan in the United States of America, or in Western civilization now, is between 77 and 81 years of age, depending on gender, depending on race. But you live somewhere between 77 and 81 years of age. In the Middle Ages, in medieval times in England, the life expectancy was 33 years. A very real difference in the average life. But it wasn't just that in Middle Ages in England you lived to 33, you suffered dramatically. There were things like tuberculosis, dysentery, smallpox, black death, leprosy. There was no such thing as medicine. Life was very cruel, very dark, and it was a very harsh reality. In England, in the Middle Ages, it was a known fact. It was a known fact that it's bad for your health to bathe, certainly in the winter. And the average person would not take a bath during the winter. You ever speak to somebody who sat Shiva and for 7 days didn't shower? We're not talking 7 days, we're not talking 7 weeks, we're talking month after month without showering. You're itchy and you're scratchy, and you lie down on bedclothes that are horribly scratchy, with lice that are coming out of every pore. In George Washington's day, in the Revolutionary War, when they would bury soldiers, they were covered with lice from head to toe. The encampments were so putrid and so filthy that lice were a natural part of the environment. That was when things were much more advanced. In the Middle Ages in England, people suffered dramatically. You lived in cold, dark excuses for homes. You got up out of a freezing cold bed in the morning to chop some wood, which was very harsh. You worked 14-hour days. There were no such things as dentists. The average person, by the time they hit the late 20s, early 30s, had very few teeth left in their mouth because there was no such thing as modern dentistry. The average person I know, certainly the average male I know, has broken at least one bone. In England, in the Middle Ages, when you broke a bone, it was broke. And what happens when a bone is broken and it sets wrong is that's how it is for life. So if you broke a leg, that meant from that age of 12 years on, you knew you were limping. And if you broke an arm or a hand or that arm bothered you, and there was arthritis that set in, and there was no cure. There was no aspirin, there was no cure. The average life for the average citizen in those days was very, very harsh. Today, we don't even know what those words mean. We have food aplenty, we live in comfortable quarters, we have heat, we have air conditioning, we have every imaginable health advance, and largely, you would say, we don't suffer. And it is true. On one scale, we suffer remarkably less than people did back then. However, I think there's another scale of measure in which we suffer much, much more than people back then did. And that is, we don't suffer physically, but I believe that we suffer a whole lot more mentally. It seems to me that there's a whole lot more mental anguish, mental pain. There's a lot more anxiety. There's a lot more neurosis. You see, in the Middle Ages, you were born into what you were, and that's where you stayed. There was a caste system, if not legally, certainly by reality. You were born a tailor, and that's what you became. If your father was a shepherd, that's what you were, and you knew what you were. Who am I? What am I? What should I do for a living? What am I going to be? How can I get... The amount of neurosis, the amount of anxiety, the amount of busyness that brings stress that we live through in our society was largely non-existent back then. Life was very harsh. It was very stark. But the nervousness, the tension, the stress, the running, the hustle, the bustle, the moving. If you trace back historically, you'll find people were never a tenth as busy back then as they are now. And there weren't 15 different things with cell phones and beepers and 8 faxes and 16 things that I didn't do in the past minute and I overdue. And that level of busyness, nervousness, anxiety, and that whole package of suffering is something that modern man has discovered and that wasn't there back then. And the reason why I think that's important to focus on is because there is a rather famous Meiri that says that the basis, the very basis of our emunah is to understand that no suffering, small or large, is accidental. Says the Meiri, every single amount of pain that a human being suffers on this planet is directly related to them, brought to them for a very specific purpose, but nothing, no pain, no suffering exists without a very real cause, without a very real reason. And I believe that while some pain could be to be mechaper, some pain could be for things that we've done wrong, I believe a lot of pain has a much more simple reason. And that is because pain has an interesting effect. Suffering has an interesting effect. It changes the way we look at things. It changes the way we view things. And I believe there are many times when HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings a person suffering, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings a person pain, simply for that person to think, to look at life differently, to look at situations differently, to view themselves and the world they live in with a different light. And it's a very interesting thing about pain, suffering, and all of the package that it comes with, is that it works. A man like Yonah was a tzaddik, tokif chasidus, so a powerful, powerful, righteous man. Nothing could get him to change, but something did. And not even great pain, not even pain that's extraordinary to unimaginable, just uncomfortable, just that sense of suffering changed his thought process. And my friends, I believe that's very much the tool, and that's the vehicle that Hashem uses oftentimes, suffering, discomfort, stress, because what that does is it changes our attitude, changes our way of looking at things, and Hashem brings it to us for that reason. And it's a very interesting thing, because pain only works if you allow it to. But if you don't, it won't do its job. So you can imagine, Rahman al-Tzlan, you're sliding into third, and your ankle stays here, but the rest of your body goes there, and you see it. You hear the crack, and you see it. It's like a flap. It's no longer a foot. It's like a flap just held on by a piece of skin. And you turn white. The pain is so excruciating, you turn white, and they carry you off the field. You can't describe the unbearable pain. And for 3 days, the throbbing is so intense, there's nothing that stops it. And finally, it heals up. And finally, after months of therapy, you're improved. After a couple of years, it's pretty much just scar tissue. And you ask yourself, what did I gain? What did I learn from it? And my friends, this is the punchline. If you don't turn your mind to learn a lesson from it, you may not. And that's a very sad fact. Because you might have had to suffer through Gehenim. You might have had to suffer through that pain for its lesson, and you might well have blown it because you didn't take the time to say, what's it here to teach me? What's the point? Why is Hashem visiting this upon me? Why do I need this? What is this here to help me understand? Because if you don't take that step with pain, it may not do its trick. It may hurt, it may throb, it may kill you. It may be an intense, unbearable pain. But if you don't take that second step of saying, what's pshat? Why did Hashem bring this to me? What does Hashem want me to learn from this? What am I supposed to gain? It won't do its job. You'll live through it, suffer through it, and gain nothing from it. And that's a little bit sad. Because there are things that we suffer through. And if you think about it, there are many things we suffer through. We suffer setbacks, we suffer anxiety, we suffer stress, we suffer problems with relationships, we suffer problems with business, we suffer mental stress, anxiety, uncertainty. There are many, many things that go through our life. Think back to the medieval times. Think back to those people who got up with scratchiness and hunger and famine and disease, and think of what a harsh reality. And if you take a person from their life and put them into our life, I think they might run back. Take me back to the manor. Take me back to serfdom, because it was calm. I didn't have the mental anxiety, the stress, the worries, the troubles. I was calm and relaxed. And my friends, I'm not telling you that this is the end-all and be-all for suffering. It's not the total answer. But I do believe, as Amiri says, that there are many times when a person has to suffer, has to bear through pain, has to bear through embarrassing situations, because it's supposed to change me, mold me, give me a different attitude, a different vantage point, because I'm supposed to come out a greater individual. But again, if you don't pay attention, if you don't ask yourself the why, it doesn't do its job, it doesn't do its trick. A great man like Jonah suffered much. He suffered on the boat, he suffered at the base of the boat, he suffered being thrown into the yam, but it didn't change him, it didn't move him. Only when he was inside the dog, only when he suffered and then stopped vayispala to understand what's Hashem want from me, what is the point of it, then he changed. But if you suffer through things but don't change, it doesn't work. Near-death experiences changes a person's attitude. That's what Rav Shimon Bar Yochai lived through. See, he lived through 12 years of Amelus B'Torah, 12 years of pure, intense Limud HaTorah, 12 years of being nothing but Dovik to Hashem, and he came out a different human being. But there are some shortcuts. It doesn't take necessarily 12 years to change your life. Near-death experiences, going to a funeral, by the way. Not even someone that close, but going to a funeral and seeing the urn and seeing a body and saying, wow, that's life, can change you. Can change your attitude, change your vantage point. You're just less frivolous. You're just less into the toys. Luxuries don't mean as much. There's got to be more meaning. But at the end of the day, one of the tools that Hashem uses to help us understand life, one of the tools that Hashem uses to help us relate to values in life is pain, is suffering. And in the world we live in, we don't suffer. Rarely do we suffer pains. Migraines occasionally, headaches occasionally, but derech klal, most people you know suffer very little physical pains. And I believe in our generation, the way Hashem visits us with pains is the suffering, the anxieties, the worries, the daigas, all of that huge package of mental anxieties. And they're there to teach us, to help us to grow. But if you suffer through it but don't pay attention, not only are you wasting your time, but you're wasting Hashem's time. He put that very special tool in the world, in your life. Specifically, you should wake up specifically so you should understand it. Not only did you suffer through it, but you didn't get the point. And I think it's a great lesson to learn from Yonah, that even a man of such dedication, such height, needed this tool. With all of his greatness, Tokiv Chasiduso, he would have been wrong and would have been nenash for it. But Hashem brought him that one tool to help him suffering, pain, hardship, so that he should do tshuva. And if it applies to Yonah, it applies to us much more. And I'd like to close with one last observation. I had a friendship with a child psychiatrist, and we were at a certain point we were learning and we were discussing things at different points, and at a certain point he said to me something interesting. He said, you know, I see you don't like your children to skin their knees. And what he was talking about was the fact that I was very, very careful to protect my children from all types of discomforts, and I was particularly sensitive that when it came to social situations, they shouldn't feel rejection, they shouldn't feel left out, they shouldn't feel the normal things that children feel. And he said to me, you're making a mistake. Children have to skin their knees. They have to feel pain. And I realized something, and he was right. Oftentimes in our efforts to protect our children, we get a little carried away. We certainly don't want our children to suffer physical skin knees. We don't want them to suffer embarrassment. We don't want them to suffer rejection. We don't want them to suffer the full gamut of what it means to be a social outcast of whatever extent. And we try very much to protect them. And my friends, I'm a big advocate of being careful with your children's self-esteem, being very, very careful about that. But at the same time, it is a very good thing for a child with good self-esteem to feel rejection, to feel left out, to feel not a part of things, to feel there's a group of children who excluded him or her, to feel a sense of not belonging. And you know why? Because when a child feels that, they become a more deep, more sensitive child. You ever hear the expression spoiled brat? Spoiled brats are the kids who get their way all the time. They're always the first chosen on the team, and they get all the best toys, and they're always popular, and everything goes their way, and they're a spoiled brat. And they can't feel another human being's pain. They can't relate to another human being. And believe me, when there's a kid excluded, when there's one kid who's not chosen on a team, who do you think it is who stands up for that child? I guarantee you, it's the child himself who felt excluded once, who felt left out. But it's not the kid who's always the number one, who's always the most popular. And the reality is, as parents, part of our job is to allow our children sometimes to skin their knees, sometimes to feel pain. Again, you have to be careful. You have to make sure your child has a good sense of self. But the reality is that as I grew older as a parent, I was a lot less cautious about this. I was a lot less careful. And my friends, I believe there's a mighty important lesson for us in that. And that lesson is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is our Father. Hashem is our Father who loves us far more than we love our physical children. And Hashem understands that every once in a while we need our knees to be skinned. Every once in a while we need to feel rejection. Every once in a while we need to feel left out. Every once in a while we need to feel that sense of the world is against me. Everything I touch fails. Nothing works. And while it's an uncomfortable sense, that sense can lead to a person's greatness, because it's that suffering, it's that pain that ultimately leads a person to humility, ultimately leads a person to depth of understanding, ultimately leads a person to be closer to Hashem, provided one thing. Provided a person has the philosophical depth to say, what's pshat? There are no accidents. Things don't just occur. Things don't just happen. The Meiri says there's no pain on this planet that is visited to a Jew without a plan, without a purpose. What is the plan? What is the purpose? What does Hashem want from me? And oftentimes you won't know the answer immediately. You won't see it clearly in front of you. But asking that question, understanding there's an answer, and searching for that answer ultimately can bring you to much greater depth, to much greater understandings, and it may very well be that Hashem is visiting that situation upon you specifically because you need it, specifically so that you should grow. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu allow us to use these Yomim Noroim for the purpose of growing, of accomplishing, being Dovik to Hashem. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu learn to understand the purpose of suffering and why we're on the planet.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozin' free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax-deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.